Hello everyone and welcome to Paleocast. I'm Laura Soule.
And I'm Dave Marshall.
Today we've got Dr. Jørn Harum with us from the Natural History Museum in Oslo in Norway. He's going to be talking to us about some of the work that he does in the far north in Svalbard, looking at marine reptiles from the Mesozoic.
So I remember you saying that you did some research on marine reptiles, or that you're going to be doing as part of your PhD project?
Yes, I'm going to be doing some. I've actually just started looking at them. So I don't do any digging up of the fossils, but I am going to have a look at them all and look at the research that people have done and try and build a big macroevolutionary picture about what was going on in their evolutionary history.
So this is kind of homework for you, isn't it?
Yep, definitely. I have my pen and my notebook ready. I'm going to write down everything he says.
So joining us today is Dr. Jørn Harum, who's of the Natural History Museum in Oslo. Hi, Jørn.
Hi.
Could you give us a little introduction to yourself and tell us how you became a paleontologist and what kind of research you do?
Well, I decided to be a paleontologist when I was like 5 or 6 years old. And it was all about this one book that was read out loud to me by my mother, I think, about a small boy that was walking along a gravel road and throwing stones. And then one of the stones said, "Don't throw me away. I'm a trilobite and I have a story to tell." And something clicked in my brain at that moment. I was one of these kids that are, well, thinking a lot. Who am I? Where do I come from? And so on. And then I understood that fossils could actually tell part of that story, and a part of that story that no humans have ever experienced. And that became the goal of my whole life, to study fossils, to learn more about my the life before man.
And so is it trilobites that you're still interested in?
That was one of my introductions. I started, the first thing I ever found was a crinoid, a Silurian crinoid. Nobody could tell me what it was. It was just a piece of a stem, so it looked like an earthworm. So everybody said, "Oh, it's a petrified earthworm," but of course it was not. But it took me many years to understand what that was. So, but I still got that fossil in my office today, and it's really fun to have that. And I started to collect. I grew up in an area where there are Silurian, lower Silurian rocks, and so I started collecting brachiopods, corals, and crinoids and stuff, and had my own small museum in my room and so on. So so it was from early childhood that I decided to become a paleontologist.
So when you went on, like through school and onto university, did you take courses in paleontology, or did you do lots of other things as well?
No, well, I started the University of Oslo, and I knew that I was going to study paleontology. So so I took all the courses, all the fun courses in paleontology, and then I had to take all the more boring courses in mathematics and other introductory courses, of course. But but I knew all the way what I was going to do. And I thought for a long time that I was going to study trilobites and maybe Paleozoic fossils. But then I met my supervisor, Sofia Kilan-Jaworowska. She's also nicknamed the Queen of the Mesozoic. She's a Polish professor that led expeditions in the Gobi Desert in the late 1960s and beginning of the 1970s. And she had all this fantastic material of early mammals from the Cretaceous. And I was able to work with her on that material for a long time. So I did both my master and my PhD on that material.
So you were looking at early mammals then, you said, from the Gobi Desert, but I understand your main group of interest at the moment is something quite different to that. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I like to switch. I get bored sometimes about working only with one group. I want to learn more about what other scientists have done in other groups too. But I stayed with invertebrates for my work, and So I switched with a postdoc in Tyrannosaurids, and then I got a position here at the museum in Oslo, at the Natural History Museum, as a curator of vertebrate paleontology. And I was told that, okay, we have a long tradition of doing field work in polar areas, and you should consider doing something in Spitsbergen, in Svalbard, or somewhere really high north, because that's a tradition at our museum. And most of what they have done so far from our museum was Devonian fish. And I didn't want to go into that. So I was thinking about this for a while. And then we had this one plesiosaur at the museum that was collected in 1931 by some American medical doctors that overwintered in Longyearbyen in Spitsbergen. And I put a student on looking at that specimen again. And then a couple of years later, there came this one opportunity that some people that had been on an excursion to one locality in Spitsbergen, and they told me about an area where they had found a skeleton. So we went up in 2004 to excavate that one specimen. And in 3 days, we found 11 more skeletons around that one. So we understood that, hey, there's something going on here.
Yeah, 11 is a lot.
So before we get into the details of those specimens, could you tell us a little bit about Svalbard? Spitsbergen?
Yeah, well, Svalbard is the name of the archipelago, and Spitsbergen is one. It's the main island, and we work on the main island. It's about 78 degrees north. That means a lot further north than the northern tip of Alaska. And that's so it's really, really far north. And going from Oslo, it's about 3 hours in a plane. It's the same as going to almost going to Morocco from Oslo. So it's a long journey, and it's a lot of logistics to do these excavations. But it's really fun.
So can you metaphorically take us there? What do you have to do to actually get out into Svalbard?
Well, the nice thing about Svalbard is it's very accessible now. There are one plane every day going, sometimes even two, so it's easy to access the main city or village. It's called Longyearbyen. It's about a little bit more than 2,000 people living there, From that place, it's all wilderness around. It's like a polar desert. There's no trees, very little grass, just rocks. And that's what we like, of course. Nothing that grows on it, nothing that covers it. So you can have a storm and you can have new fossils being blown into view just by one storm, because the shale is just blowing away. So it's really nice, and we're working not too far away from Longyearbyen. It's like 1.5 hours with a small with a rubber boat, and then a couple of hours walk. So it's quite easy access. But the problem, of course, is that I need a lot of people to do this excavation. So I need like 12 to 15 people in several weeks. And then we need to fly in all the equipment. We need to fly in all the food. We need to fly in tents and everything for this group, because we cannot travel in and out of this village every day. So we stay out there in tents for 2 to 3 weeks every summer.
So you said you stay out there for 2 to 3 weeks. Why is it such a short period?
Well, all in all, we have a weather window of about 5 weeks when we can do any excavations there. This is so far north that from the snow melts on the mountain until it's covered with new snow again, it's usually less than 5 weeks. So we have a very short period of time when we need to do extensive digging and excavations. And I tried to push my group to stay more than 3 weeks, but then people start to collapse. So it's better to have them collapsing at home when they return, because it's hard labor. We're not allowed to bring out any bulldozers or anything like that. So we do everything by hand. And one excavation of one specimen we calculated last year was 40 tons, metric tons of shale that we removed to excavate the specimen. And then we had to put all that shale back again into the hole afterwards. So when you do this much overburden, people get really tired after a while, because you do about three excavations like that in one field season.
So you're putting the shale back in the hole. Why do you need to do that?
Well, everything is protected up there. Most of it is national parks. Fortunately, this locality we're working on is just outside the national parks. So it's an area where you can travel without too many special permits. But even so, by digging these holes, we are digging the biggest holes except for the mining industry up there. So we are told that we have to fill in every hole, and we even remove all our tracks from the mountainside when we leave again. There should be no signs of us having a camp there for 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh, you got to remove footprints?
Yes, every footprint. We rake the whole mountain.
And why is who tells you that you need to do this?
This is the governor of Svalbard. That's the highest police and also other part of the government of Svalbard that tells us that this is the rules and you have to obey to them if you want to do any field work. So there should be no traces left. So actually they come out with helicopters and inspect a few weeks after we leave. Usually we hope for snow, so they see it. But sometimes they come out and inspect before the snow, and to see that there are no holes for even the pegs from the tents, there should be no holes after this. There should be no tracks on the mountainside or anything like that.
So do you have to always apply for permission
every
with the
year
governor first? Yeah.
Every year we apply. So we have to make discoveries at the end of one field season for the next field season. So we need to apply with GPS on every skeleton we want to excavate, and also to place the campsites and so on, and plan everything for next year before we leave from that year.
It sounds pretty hard. I'm used to just going down to the local cliff and just knocking a bit out, but
well, I think that's part of the adventure here, is that people have known about these localities for about 100 years, but nobody's done anything with them because it's too hard. It's too much work and too much people involved, too much logistics involved, too much. We usually get a snowstorm or two. We have polar bears that we have to take care of, and so on. So it's a special kind of field work.
Have you been going out every year since you made those first discoveries? Was it 2004?
2000. Well, we didn't go out in 2005 because it turned into some problems with landowners and so on, but it all sorted out. So from 2006 to 2012, we've been there every year, so with the same crew. So it's been a crew of a few students, a few scientists, very few, and then volunteers. So it's a really good crew, and we have more than 100 nights in tent now. Or, of course, there's no nights at Svalbard at this time. This is midnight sun. But we have more than 100 nights in tents at Svalbard during these excavations.
So you say that the sun's up all night long. Are you able to work 24 hours a day then?
Yeah, if we don't collapse, we are, of course. It depends on how much Red Bull we drink, but we usually kind of turn the clock. So we start to usually get up around 11 or 12 at noon, and then we eat breakfast, and then we start to work, and we have lunch around 7 in the evening, and then we work until 12 or 1 o'clock at night and have dinner. It's very strange because most people turn almost 6 hours during this, because there's no difference in the light in day and night. The sun is just going in a small circle above your head, so we don't have a feeling of night or day during the work there. So the first few days, people are staying up very late and sleeping very little, and then they have a big headache, and then they start to sleep the normal amount of hours they really need. So it's a difference, but we're so physically tired that nobody have a problem sleeping, even if it's very, very light inside the tents.
Do you find that you get strange suntans?
Yeah, well, mostly we call it a windburn. I don't know if you use that in English, because it's a lot of wind, and if you have sun at the same time, or even not sun but overclouded, you will get this windburns, and sometimes they can be quite bad, like you see on some of these polar expedition guys with blisters in their chins or in their lips. But usually we know how to handle this before it goes too far.
One thing you mentioned were the polar bears. Now, I've heard something that might be an urban myth, I don't know, is that there's more polar bears on Svalbard than there are people. Is that true?
Yeah, well, it depends on who you ask. Some of the counts are that there are twice as many polar bears than people. Some of the more conservative counts are that there are about the same amount of polar bears as people. So it depends on who you ask, really.
What does the governor of Svalbard say?
Well, they are protected, of course. You're not even allowed to go. If you see one, you're not allowed to approach it at all, and we're really there for the fossils, so it's not like we are really happy to see a polar bear to get photographs, to say that. So when we have polar bears close to camp, we had one going down at by the fjord 1 year for two or 3 days, and that was kind of annoying, because you have to put some of the people that could be used for digging, you have to put them with binoculars and a gun instead, and they had just have to watch the polar bear for several days until it leaves, because the rest of the crew is, of course, with the head down and bumps up, so they don't see anything, because they lie in a quarry and dig all the day. So then you need to have some that are polar bear guards just to watch the polar bear.
With being at such a high latitude, do you have any problem with permafrost?
Well, permafrost is our friend, because some years we have the permafrost at like 1.2 meters deep. That's really good year. Most years we have it less than 1 meter, and in a bad year you hit the permafrost on 70 centimeters. The first years we thought we could melt it by using we had this special contraptions making steam and so on, and trying different ways to melt it. But then we discovered that actually, by instead using jackhammers, we can shape the shale much easier when it's in permafrost than when it's not. So it's actually part of using the permafrost, because it makes the rock more stable. So the best parts of a skeleton is also is always the parts embedded in the shale in the permafrost. So then we use jackhammers and just cut around, and we also have rock saws and so on. So we cut around and just let them be frozen until we have completely embedded them in a plaster jacket.
So has Oslo really become the center for studying these fossils now?
Yeah, it's really fun because we didn't know that it turned out to be this rich from the beginning, and we had no plan. It was not very, very well dated either. So what it turned out to be is that, of course, we have a high boreal fauna of marine reptiles, both ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs and pliosaurs, from the uppermost, the Jurassic, just at the border to the Cretaceous. So it's there's a lot of interest in what we are doing now, and that's of course good for us and very fun to be able to discuss with other scientists around the world.
So you said plesiosaurs, ichthyosaurs and pliosaurs. What did these animals look like when they were alive? Can you think of any modern examples that they look a bit like for our listeners?
Yeah, well, ichthyosaurs are easy because they look like fat, overeaten dolphins. So they are easy to, except that of course the tail is differently shaped, and they are reptiles, not mammals like dolphins. The shape of them is similar, so it's easy to recognize them. But the plesiosaurs, they are a weird bunch. It's like taking a turtle shell and pressing a snake through it, and then you have the long neck sticking out in front of the turtle shell. It's they didn't have a shell, but they were round bodies, and they have a long neck and four similarly shaped and almost the same sized flippers and a very short tail. So we have no animals today that can really explain how they moved or how they fed or anything. It's plesiosaurs are really strange. Pliosaurs are, well, they are actually short-necked plesiosaurs. But they are related to plesiosaurs, pliosaurs too. But they are more like if you have this big body with four similar paddles and a short tail, and then you put a big crocodile head on in front of it with a very short neck, then you have this one, the pliosaur. So these three are living in the ocean at the end of the Jurassic, up about at that time, this ocean was about 60 degrees north. That means 65 to 70 degrees north, I think the new estimate is, and that means that it's far north in mainland Norway today. But they lived in an ocean up there, and the ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs, they were eating maybe mostly cephalopods, ammonites, belemnites, and other non-shelled cephalopods. And then you have the pliosaur, that was like the big predator of the ocean at that time. It was bigger than the ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs. It could be up to 13 meters. The skull, the pieces of the biggest skull we found indicates a skull of about 2.5 meters. And it was a huge animal and a big predator that was eating both the ichthyosaurs and the plesiosaurs probably in the ocean at that time.
So do you have a complete food web? Are you able to say this one fed on that one, these fed on this? Do you have everything from the ammonites all the way through to the plesiosaurs?
We don't have any stomach content, so we can't be completely sure, of course. But we have some indications of bite marks, a very few, but a few bite marks. So it could be that, for example, plesiosaurs or ichthyosaurs were scavenging on dead animals of the opposite or the same type. But of course, the pliosaur was the top predator. That's for sure. But we have not any stomach content or anything that can tell about that part. So we have the big animals we got, and then we're missing a lot in the section from information, or maybe we're not missing it. We don't really know, because we find cephalopods, ammonites, belemnites, and hooks of other cephalopods. We find lots of it in the section, but we find nearly no fish bones. Almost none at all. So we're really wondering, are they missing from this part of the ocean? Are there very few of them? Is this an ocean dominated by cephalopods? Like, actually, there's an ecosystem down by the Antarctic today that's described as dominated by cephalopods. So it's possible, but we don't have the real explanation for this. And from the cephalopods and down, we have lots of bivalves, we have crinoids, we have other echinoderms like brittle stars and other things from the echinoderms, and then we have the microfossils. So we have the almost the whole picture, I think. But it's very weird with the missing piece. That's the bony fish.
And is this food web represented in the numbers of each specimen? So the top predator, there should be fewer of those. So are there just a couple of pliosaurs, a few more ichthyosaurs, loads of belemnites?
Well, we have never counted the belemnites and ammonites, because I tell you, there's millions on the sea, on the mountainsides, so you can pick them everywhere. It's quite spectacular. But when it gets to the marine reptiles, we have two partial pliosaurs, and we have about the same number, around 17 or 18 of ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs skeletons. That we have collected. And then, of course, there's a lot of skeletons we have not collected, but it seems to be a quite equal number of ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs on the mountainsides, but the pliosaurs are much rarer.
Okay, and of those, how many different species? Are they all the same species? All the ichthyosaurs are the same species, all the pliosaurs and plesiosaurs?
That's maybe turning into be quite an embarrassment soon, because this is not one layer. This what we find is in the stratigraphic column is about 12 million years of black shales, and it's really well dated now, all the different layers, and we have stratigraphic control of every specimen we have collected within these 12 million years. So we have hoped now to find more than one of each species, but it turns out that most of what we collect are single specimens of different species. And we have so many. So far, we have described only less than half of the species we're going to do in the end. I guess in the end there will be nearly 10 new species of plesiosaurs and 10 new of ichthyosaurs if we're getting in the way we're looking now. So that's quite a lot compared to the rest of the world. But that is because nobody's seen a high boreal ecosystem from the Upper Jurassic before, so it's a quite isolated area in the Upper Jurassic, and we will expect to find many endemic species.
So 12 million years seems like quite a long time for you to have there. Is there any chance that some of these different species that you're seeing could be ancestral to one another?
Well, that's what we really hope. That's what we really hope, because we have. It looks like there's only one group of ichthyosaurs, the ophthalmosaurids, so far, and we have them from the bottom of the section until the top of the section. And of course, what you expect to see is some kind of macroevolutionary pattern, and I really hope so. And we're getting into new specimens now. We're preparing several specimens down in the lab, and we have some really beautiful specimens coming up the next years. There will be Lena, a student of mine. She will do a PhD on the ichthyosaurs now, starting, well, she had just had a child, so she will start again in May and do the ichthyosaurs, the whole run of ichthyosaurs, and look for macroevolutionary patterns. And then another student of mine, Aubrey, she will go to Southampton now and start a study of the plesiosaurs and compare them also to more southern plesiosaurs from the end of the Jurassic, like in the Kimmeridge clay. But also there, it looks like there could be some macroevolutionary signals, not so evident as what we see in the ichthyosaurs. There are patterns in the ichthyosaurs already that looks really, really cool. But I hope we can see some kind of pattern also in the plesiosaurs in the coming next 3 years.
You're talking about these patterns. What kind of things would you be looking for? What sorts of changes over time?
I don't think I want to tell everything now, but
okay.
But we have reduction of limbs in ichthyosaurs like you have never seen before.
Okay.
And we have a good pattern of this through those 12 million years. It's almost like the story of horse evolution from 4, 5 to 3 to 2 to 1 toe. So it will be some really good stories about the adaptation and the late evolution of ichthyosaurs that's never been told before. And I hope that we will do something like this with the plesiosaurs too, even but they look more specialized maybe for this ocean because they have different scale of flippers compared to more southern plesiosaurs at the same time. So they're different in several ways, also to do with swimming modes, but we do not understand that pattern yet.
So you're looking at the evolution going forwards, but do these fossils that you're recovering tell you anything about the evolution backwards? What did they have a common ancestor?
Well, they're so specialized already in the Upper Jurassic. These marine reptiles are so specialized. It's really hard to say something. But next year, I'm starting a new project in the mid-Triassic, just one mountain further east of what we have been working now for 8 years. And there we got complete mixosaurids, middle Triassic ichthyosaurs. And of course, they are in the intermediate between something that are more like, have something that looks almost like limbs to the more specialized Jurassic ichthyosaurs. So we're going to look more at the beginning of the evolution of ichthyosaurs with the next project that I'm starting to do field work on next year.
So with so many fossils just lying around in Svalbard, has there always been a long history of research into the Jurassic?
No, well, the whole history of Mesozoic vertebrates on Svalbard has been focused on the Triassic all the time. The early Swedish expeditions collected quite a lot of early ichthyosaurs and other marine reptiles and amphibians from the Triassic. In the beginning of the 1900s and the late 1800s too. But since then, only a few different small expeditions have collected anything in the areas. And nobody's ever done any good collecting in the Jurassic before we started.
Why is that? Did they simply not realize that there were fossils there, or were they not interested?
Well, I think most paleontologists are quite lazy. Yeah. They go to a desert where it's nice weather and where they can bring a cooler full of beer, and then they collect the dinosaur and then they go back home. This is not the way we have to do it in Svalbard. Of course, we have much less. We do not have any alcohol in field at all because we have so many guns. And we have all this weather. In a good day, it's 10 degrees Celsius. If it's a really good day, usually it's around 5. But it could get down to 0. And in the middle of the summer, when we're there, we still have snow covering maybe 1 or 2 times during the dig. And then we usually have one storm, and that's a real storm, and there's nothing to hide behind. So we have made pegs for the tents, like the longest ones are 75 centimeters that we drive down into the permafrost to keep the tents staying there during the storms. So it's a lot of logistics and a lot of being cold and wet all the time. You have to like this. And I think most paleontologists, they like warm deserts and not cold deserts.
So you've talked about digging these huge holes in the ground and using plaster cast while the permafrost is still present. Sounds like a pretty involved process. Presumably these fossils are quite delicate. How do you actually get these things out of the ground and back to Oslo without damaging them?
We use field jackets like it's been done for more than 100 years in dinosaur digs in North America. We use the same techniques with burlap and plaster, and first covering the fossils with 3 to 5 layers of wet toilet paper, and then adding plaster, and then plaster with burlap, and then of course some iron strengthening within the last layers of burlap and plaster. So we get these huge field jackets that they can be up to like 800 kilos each with sediments and bones inside. Then we flip them over and start to clean them out from the underside until we get down to the bones, and then we seal off with plaster on that side too. So they turn into this huge, a little bit flattened, but they look like big burlap eggs. It's hard to get them on pallets, but when we get them on pallets and strap them down, we have helicopters coming and get them. And they fly them to Longyearbyen, to the village, and we have a whole container staying there for transport by ship. So we with trucks we put everything inside the container and put it on the ship, and 5 weeks later we usually have the fossils at the museum in a big container, shipping container. And then of course it's all still quite wet, so it needs to dry before we start to open the jackets, and usually it takes about 1 year to dry completely the jackets because they're so big. And then when we do this, we take them down into the basement of the museum where we have a small lab, and we open the jackets and start the long work of gluing the specimens together, because of this permafrost and also being frozen and torn so many times. Everything is like, if you take a packet of crackers and you jump on it, and then you try to glue together the crackers again one by one. This is what happens with these bones. You can actually push your finger straight through the bones when we collect them. So we have to be really careful not brushing too much. So a lot of the work in the lab is, when we open the jacket, is to stabilize the bones until we can remove the shale that's around them. Because the shale is the whole support, together with the plaster, that keeps the shape of the bones together. And then I have some very patient very patient preparator and a few students that spend hundreds of hours down in the basement gluing these bones together until we can study them.
It must be quite exciting having this, having had this big burlap egg waiting out to dry for a year in your lab, and then finally getting to crack it open and have a look.
Oh yeah, and we know what's inside. Sometimes it's a good skull, sometimes it's the hind limbs or something like that. So we're really looking forward to open these jackets. And now we have a complete skull of the first plesiosaur ever from Svalbard waiting, drying up downstairs. So we have some really good things coming, but we have to clean up all the specimens. And with now almost 40 specimens collected, we have about 10 years of gluing in front of us.
Do you need any more volunteers?
Yeah, I'm always happy. When somebody comes to the museum and asks if they can volunteer and wants to glue bones, I'm always happy to say yes. And then we usually test them for 1 day. More than half of them get mad within 1 day, so we can't use them. but the others, they stay and think it's fun. But you have to be extremely patient person to do this. It's not for me, I think. It's too slow. It goes. You can keep on working on one femur or one humerus for maybe 2 weeks before it's completely out of the rock, and it takes so much time. It's so important, but really, I'm a little bit too patient to do it myself. So I'm really happy that I have people that have more patience.
So, with all the logistics and the time it takes and the people involved, it must be a massive operation to just get all of these fossils to the museum and get them on display. Who actually finances this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have sponsors, and that's quite uncommon for any project in Norway. Any researcher in Norway really to use sponsors. But I decided that I want to do this my way. I tried the Science Foundation in Norway once, and they said, "Well, you have not found the skeletons yet. You will not get money of us for going looking for them." And so it's kind of a catch-22 at that point. So in Norway, we have, of course, we have the oil in the North Sea, and that's in the Upper Jurassic. So I started to approach some oil companies, and they thought, "Okay, this sounds like fun, and it's just small money." I asked just for like £15,000 from each of them. So several of them gave me money to do this, and we managed through doing a lot of outreach. We got quite a brand name in Norway, and managed to hook up to several oil companies and get small money out of them. But together, it was enough to run all this large logistics and field experience, and also the travel company at Svalbard that runs a lot of the guided tours and so on for tourists in from Longyearbyen. They said, "Well, we're interested in this. This sounds good. Why can't we pay for all your plane tickets to Svalbard and all your hotel stays on the way out and the way in Longyearbyen? And what you will give us back is just to guide one group a day in the excavations with tourists." And I said, "Well, if the groups are not too big, we can do it." So in that way, suddenly I had all the plane tickets and I had all the hotel stays in Longyearbyen. And it goes like this. It's just small money all the time. And then we go to one of the tent makers in Norway and ask if he can get some tents to us. And so the only thing we really pay for is the helicopter, and that's quite expensive. The helicopter and the shipping of the container, that's the two things that we need to pay every year. The rest is actually covered by sponsors.
That sounds ideal. It sounds like you're going to Svalbard, getting everything for free, holding your volunteers at gunpoint to work until they collapse.
Yeah, that's more or less it. It's the way I want to do it. And it works. We're getting a lot of really good specimens out for almost nothing. So it's all about attitude, I think.
Well, yeah, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you think you might go down and volunteer?
Yeah, for sure. It sounds like fun. Well, hard work, but fun. And you should definitely volunteer. We'll do a PhD.
Yeah, well, not on vertebrates. Team Paleozoic with Joe. I mean, it's interesting that he was saying about all the Devonian fish. I think that's one that Joe's just really missed out on there. Probably could
Yeah.
have added a little bit. But it's kind of disheartening to hear all of the work that goes into actually getting out into these remote locations, or the permissions that you need, or the logistics, because I'm trying to plan a field trip of my own into somewhere stupid and cold and far north and far away and dangerous.
Probably worth it in the end, though.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if you get as many specimens as and as big and as beautiful as you're getting out of Svalbard, then definitely be worth it. But
Yeah.
I think I might need a few volunteers, and they might be harder to convince to follow me rather than to follow you on a proper professional paleontologist.
Pick me. I'll go.
Yeah, you can come. We can just have a
Yes.
paleocast field trip led
That'd
by
be good.
me. So, although they're getting all of these specimens out, and it's important to get such well-preserved specimens, I think one of the nicest things about all of this is that they've got a near complete ecosystem and a near complete section of about 12 million years, which is going to give such invaluable paleoecological data. So just show us how the entire ecosystem functioned, which I think is really, really important.
Yeah, and it's quite unusual to get a section that complete for that long. And I'm only just getting into this, and already I'm seeing that potentially there's some really interesting things to be learned about macroevolution from these groups.
So I'm going to look forward to what's coming out of this Spitsbergen research group and also your research, Laura.
I guess I better get on with it then, hadn't I? I will see you next episode.
See you then, guys.
Bye.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Maybe I can do this in my radio voice. Haha, well, Laura, I'll see you next time.
Well, thank you, Dave. I'll see you then, too.
Did you have to put on your radio voice for Naked Scientist?
No, the first couple of times I did recordings with them, I accidentally had a radio voice because I was, like, very self-conscious, in a studio and stuff. It's strange. So the first couple of things I did are... Hello and welcome to the Naked Scientists. My name's Laura Soul, and today I'll be talking to you about... So I sound like, I don't know, story time from the 1930s.
You sounded pretty good then, actually. You sounded proper BBC.
Yeah, I know, but
too gentle. Not... You need to be authoritative, woman.
Hello and welcome to the Channel 4 Evening News.
Hello and welcome to the Channel 4 Evening... No, I need to be more manly and deep. Hello, yeah. And welcome to the Channel 4 News.
Yeah, but there's two types of radio voice. There's that type of radio voice, and then there's, hello, and we're moving on into the evening with some excellent tunes from my favourite...
long and drawn-out radio voice. Hey, you're listening to PaleoCast Radio. I'm your host, Dave Marshall.
And I'm the co-host, Laura.
I think that went a bit into David Bowie.
But it sounds stupid when women do that anyway, so she says. When I do a David Bowie accent.
Do your David Bowie.
Bowie!
What? What was that?
What is it? The Thing.
Yeah, The Thing. Was it when David Bowie was a Pokemon?
No.
Bowie!
Oh, I thought you were going to... See, it's very confusing for me because you guys don't do this the same as anyone before, because you just start chattering away to me and I'm like, la, 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 I'm having a chat. And then I sound like, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I do.
Are you sure?
It's because you're being all casual. And you're going to put this in now, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Please don't. Please, not on the first one.